Okay, so this is the we're entering into the 11th hour. Now, now this is interesting that the phrase at the 11th hour is a common phrase really in our culture. And the way that phrase is used is the way something can change at the 11th hour. The way something can move from being going one way to going a completely different way. So the 11th hour, in a certain sense, is a dangerous place. Because it's a place where a process has been going, developing, 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 and we're right at the edge where something could happen, could manifest, or could not manifest. Can go in one of two directions. Now, in the Book of Gates, this is one of the moments. This is the moment when Apep, who is this energy of resistance to the flow of the universe, strongly attacks. This is almost the Apep's last stand before the emergence into the Akhet, the emergence into the horizon. And what we see happening really is in the, and I'll go through the details of the Book of Gate of the hours in hour later in the weekend, but the what we see happening is a sudden emergent resurgence of Apep. And the protective power, the power that helps us in this hour, is the goddess Sevket, who is the serpent, the scorpion goddess. And in Egyptian tradition, she is the one who helps protect us against the venom of the serpent. And it's this interesting, almost homeopathic idea of the poisonous goddess, the goddess who is the living scorpion, who can protect us against venom. And she's one of a quaternity of goddesses that you'll find in Egyptian tombs. You find there are at the corners of the final sarcophagus you get in most Egyptian tombs is a great oblong box. I mean, sometimes it on the lid it has the image of the person, but the more mummiform images are inside that box. And in each of the corners, there is a figure of a woman holding out her arms, which are winged, so that the person inside the coffin is surrounded on all sides by these winged goddesses, whose job it is to protect, but not just to protect, to allow the person to rise up, to rise up out of the duat into the kingdom of the stars. And there are four goddesses that do this. There is, as I said, there is Serket, who is the serpent goddess. Opposite her, there is the goddess Neit, who is the weaver goddess, who is the goddess of war, and who kills. And so both these goddesses have the images of creation and destruction. The other two goddesses are the goddess Isis and the goddess Nephthys, the two sisters, sometimes called the Bright Sister and the Dark Sister. And they're often found, Isis and Nephthys are often found standing behind Osiris in the kind of tomb paintings. So these are the protective the beings who bring opposites together, who kill and make alive. And part of what's being looked at here in this phrase, kill and make alive, is the what happens in transition, in every transition of our life, in there is that moment of something dies, something travels forward. Now, in Egyptian tradition, and at the heart of the meditation, is the sense of there are these various forms of ourselves. There are lots of, when we think of ourselves, there are lots of layers, lots of images that constitute ourself. And for the Egyptians, the deepest layer was this sense of myself made beautiful. Now, myself made beautiful is not an objectified beauty, it's the opposite of objectified beauty. It is, and so they envisioned it. They envisioned myself made beautiful as your most as being most intimately precious. So they have this image of your bones are silver, your flesh is gold. Now we have to remember, for ancient Egyptians, silver was a much more precious element than gold. Gold was much more common in ancient Egypt than silver. So when they say your bones are silver, your flesh is gold, they're saying all part of you is beautiful, all part of you is perfect, but your bones, which are your most intimate place, which is literally defines your shape, is made of the most precious thing of all. So it challenges us, in a sense, really, to see our essential form as most beautiful, as most precious. And the act of rising up is the act of rising up as this form. Now in the next hour, we will look a lot at this image of one of the great images of the 12th hour is the woman sitting on a serpent holding the star. And again, this is one of the true images of this deeper self, of myself made beautiful, of being upheld by the serpent energy. Serpent energy being life energy, being imagination, being power, and that being a throne that we sit upon, that not just sit upon, that holds us up, that enables us to rise. And what it enables us to show is the star that is our star, the shining light that is our light. Now what helps us to rise up, what helps us to do this, is the momentum of all the work that we have been doing. But in this moment, we are challenged again, because we are challenged in the place of transition by that energy that just wishes to stop everything. The whole thrust of Apep is to stop the forward movement of Ra, to stop the forward movement of life and light. It's that energy of inertia, that energy that would just let everything go cold and just dissolve, so that it just dissolves back into a chaos that has no meaning and no directionality. One of the things that we find is this figure of the goddess Serket in the upper register of this hour of the Book of Gates, laying herself on top of Apep. It's a very particular image, and holding Apep with a chain. Now, Apep is this primal energy of resistance in the universe, and Apep in Egyptian tradition, but not just the Egyptian tradition, cannot be destroyed, because that resistance to forward movement has its usefulness, is necessary, because the struggle against Apep enables qualities to come into existence that would not come into existence were there not resistance to it. So you have this figure of the scorpion goddess laying her body on top of the serpent and holding him back with a chain. So this quality of holding, and she holds, and the particular thing that with venom and is the way the throat can close and open. So she's very much connected with opening and closing. So what I want you to do for a moment is just sit upright, and I'm just going to do a short and sharp exercise. So just get yourself into an upright position. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. In front of you is a veiled mirror. The veil falls off. What do you see? Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Open your eyes. What did you see?
Yeah.
Just shut out what you saw.
I saw one of those old Mercury style mirrors where they're all watching. You can't actually see a proper reflection.
Yeah. There was great. Somebody, yeah, next.
Silver bones. I had silver bones.
Silver bones, yep.
Yeah. I was a snake with a crown. Not an Egyptian crown, I was just the big hooded cobra.
Yeah.
Not the crown. Sort of a childlike crown.
Yeah, nice, good, lovely. Yeah. Next.
I had blackness, it wasn't reflecting anything, and then as the mirror I moved a bit and then it was too much light, so it was either black or
light.
Or brightness when it's like an overexposed picture kind of.
Yeah, bright. Good.
Sorry.
I just saw myself as mirrored reflection exactly as I am.
Okay. Sorry, Jenny, I didn't quite catch what you said.
A bee.
Thank you.
I had an Isis figure with a moon crown.
Mm-hmm. Are you good?
Sorry. Yeah. I don't know if mine's muted or not. Am I muted?
No, you're not. I can hear you. Go on.
I had one of the winged beings. Mm-hmm. Which quickly changed into a really horrific, snaky scorpion face.
Mm-hmm. Great. Nice image.
I was just myself as I am now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I had a dark curtain over, and then the word, I just had crocodile coming out, the word crocodile, I didn't see it.
Yeah, great. Ali, how about you? You're muted, Ali. Ali, you're muted.
Well, that's better.
Yeah.
I saw a silver sarcophagus mask.
Mm-hmm. Good.
I had to describe, it's rather like a scar. It's in circles.
Mm-hmm.
Very carefully, sort of very loosely draped, you know. In a spiral, I suppose.
A spiral. Okay, nice. Okay, close your eyes again. Breathe in. breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Step into the mirror. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Open your eyes. Again, just tell me what happened.
I stepped into the mirror and I had to come face to face with this, with a squiggly thing. And I became the winged being.
Yeah, great.
It was very black and cobwebby.
Yeah, I just had like a black and white strobe light, and then I could see sort of scaled limbs, like, but it was just very flickery black and white, like a strobe.
Yeah, great.
I had a momentary wonder, am I actually meant to turn around and look out through the mirror in that, but that just came and went in a flash, and then I was in a field of stars.
I was on a black path with light all around.
I had quite a shock, like it went right through me and I kind of jerked and the mirror shattered into shards. And it's something like I'm me, but both sides of the mirror, I'm still me, and one side is the ordinary world and the other side is mysterious. But I'm still me, I can go in and out through that mirror now.
Yes.
I had a mirror about this big, which actually belongs to my mother, a face mirror sort of thing. And I step into it and it shatters. And I'm shocked by that. Now what happens?
Now what
happens? Something got shattered in.
I stepped in and it was all dark and I felt like I was going in another world, like it was like almost like Alice going into the kind of hole, going down into the thing. I was like, no, I'm not going down there. And then it was just felt like it was just dark or nothing there or something, I'm not sure.
Okay.
It was like stepping into Mercury and I couldn't, I was surprised I could still breathe.
Stepped into the garden and bees on my right hand side.
I just felt I was stepping into a tunnel, like you know, rather like that. I can't remember whether it's that image on the front cover of that Thames and Hudson book when you see, I mean, there wasn't an angel, but it was, I think it's called Beyond Death, but it was sort of, it was just like a funnel into, I didn't know where it was going particularly. I didn't have enough time.
No, fine.
I was Alice as well. Stepped through the looking glass.
Great. Okay, close your eyes again. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Step back through the mirror. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Open your eyes. And again, just tell me what's happened.
I step back into my body. I'm back into like who I am now here in this moment.
Great.
I'm sorry, and I didn't understand what you meant. When you say step back, do you mean sort of be outside and step backwards into the mirror? Is that what you meant?
I just meant literally step, just
out of the mirror.
Out of the mirror, whatever the phrase meant for you, really. There's no, So whatever happened to you is right, okay? So that.
Oh, okay. Because as I stepped back, I thought, okay, I'm outside the mirror again. I'm going to have to step back. So I've just got into confusion.
No, that's okay. So what happened to you? So when you step back, what happened to you?
I'm not sure because I just didn't know whether I was doing it right.
Okay, so that's what happens. There's confusion and not sure if I'm doing it right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good.
I had the same thing as Faye. I just went back into me now. It's sort of a weird backwards in time feeling, like... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, me too. Same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Me too. But the mirror was different. It was liquid. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was solid, but it was a liquid. So it could move. That was...
Sorry. Going back in. So, quite a curious thing. To go backwards, mm-hmm. and then the mirror like gave as if it was made of rubber or a membrane, mm-hmm. and I can get through it. It bent to my shape, but it wasn't gonna.
No. It bent to your shape. Okay.
That mottled feel as the mercury mirror, but that had also changed slightly. Just to check that.
Okay.
I stepped back through, and there was no glass this time, and I thought I'd go seamlessly, but I still sort of had that jerk. Mm-hmm. But the glass wasn't there, so it was just. And as I stepped through, I laughed. There's something quite elating or liberating about that process. So.
Mm. I step back with my wings.
Great.
Mm. Mm. I step back. All of the mirrors smashed, and again, Alice thing. Smashing everything going on the ground. You're nothing but a pack of cards.
Yeah.
I stepped back into a room with bare floorboards, and when I looked in the mirror, it was completely black.
I went back with such a bulk, and I didn't like it very much, and it was a bit dark, and I felt rather confused.
Wish I got Regan's wings.
I still saw the squiggly thing in the mirror, though.
If I could just add something, I was really nervous about this last one. And since then I've been feeling like something has been trying to get at me from my kidneys and my back. So there was something about going back in there and feeling there was something, I think, in there. But I don't know, it's a bit odd. I feel a bit funny now. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I said I felt, came back to the same thing, but obviously not being the same, because I've got those two mirror images within me now. So to say, you're not the same person when you come back, obviously, because that's had an effect of some kind.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when I came back, it was like I came back sort of to the edge of myself or something.
Yeah.
And the way I looked out was slightly different. There was a change.
Yeah.
When I came out, I was covered in the mercury or some silver casting sort of stuff, and I felt really protected and armoured. Mm-hmm. It was really nice. I liked it.
Yep. Good. Okay, so what we've been looking at here in this little exercise is the heart of the this whole process, really, that we've been doing of going in, coming out, and that transition process. So in a certain sense, this little meditation involves the whole of the Book of Gates.
So we could have cut out 12 months then. Sorry, Ian.
Well, could have, but it's a bit like the difference with you know, the thing that's interesting really about you, what do we use? So the Book of Gates is like a ladder to help us climb up somewhere. And we could just do this meditation over, which would be like, you know, time and time again, which would be like trying to hop to the top of a mountain. Eventually, hopefully, our muscles get strong enough to let us hop that high. But before that, we fall down a lot and bruise our bottom quite a lot first. And in a way, that one of the interesting, what Dali's saying is interesting, because the, if you're like Zen or something, it would do exactly that. You know, the whole method of something like Zen is you just pay attention to your breath. You maybe have this koan that focuses your attention, and you just do that for years. And, you know, that's not wrong. It's a very powerful method. Actually, I have a lot of respect for that. But the way of working with the imaginal is to use imaginal images as bridges, as ladders, as containers. And of course, this is, you know, the Egyptian method is exactly that, to work with images that are iconic or function like idols, and to keep working with that place of transition where we keep transforming the images of ourselves so that our sense of ourselves opens and that our deeper self has more capacity to flow through us into the world, and so that the world has the capacity to flow through our form into relationship with our deeper self. So these moments of transition, these moments of the mirror, of looking in the mirror, of stepping through the mirror, are connected really to the, you know, just this practice of transition, and what happens to us in the transition.
So is it a complete sort of tangent or red herring to focus on what you see? Is it just the act of doing it and seeing anything that matters?
Well, it's two things. You're right that the actual process is key, and what noticing what happens in the process. But the actual images are always specific to us. So they always have some sort of meaning, and often it's very hard to know what the meaning is, and it's very easy for us to dismiss them. So, I mean, sometimes there's very obvious, powerful images, but other times, other times you get very faint experiences, which sometimes can be the most powerful of all, because they're like hints and clues and kind of indications of something that we're not quite yet fully aware of somewhere.
And this seems such a useful exercise, but it seems to me it's got to be directed by another person. It's not something you can do by yourself.
You can't really, because you sort of set it up in a way. We all do. I think we all. I mean, that's the problem. That's literally the problem. Is it? And it comes from outside. You're slightly taken by surprise, and that's why the speed is so much part of it. You know, before our minds are incredibly quick, and they can very easily get hold of something and start to interpret it for us. And that's why this is an exercise that you have to do with the assistance of somebody else, really, normally. But it's sort of pivotal in a way to this hour, right? Because what's happening in this hour is we're getting ready, we're preparing to cross the horizon. So this is the moment before dawn, the moment before something's going to emerge. And it's sort of it always has been interesting to me, that, you know, given, you know, I know about the Book of Gates, and this phrase, the 11th hour, There's so much in our culture, because, and it is the moment where the whole thing can just fall apart at this point, or you can cross the horizon. And of course, it's in Egyptian tradition, this very powerful image of this is where Apep suddenly surges up. And what's interesting is what we need to help us in this hour is this rather frightening kind of figure of Sevket, the scorpion goddess. So it's like it is like meeting poison with poison. You know, and in the cosmic doctrine, Dion Fortune talks about the necessity to work with hate, and so to hate the hateful, which is an energy of opposition. You know, we have it's sort of new age thinking as you just have to love everything. Now, this isn't really, you will know already from having gone through the Book of Gates, a lot of the energies that are being called upon are energies of opposition, of fighting, of killing, and so there's that energy of working with hate, hating the hateful, that actually blocks and restrains it and forms almost a sort of a thrust block for something else to happen. You know, and it's sort of interesting sometimes. I often think, you know, I think about, Dean Fortune's great channel text, The Cosmic Doctrine. There's a lot of ideas in that are very resonant of Egyptian tradition. In particular, the image of the image of Apep, which is this image of this being that is a resistance that resists the energy of the universe. Now, the image you get in the Unfortunate Cosmic Doctrines of three great rings, there's a sense of a great spinning ring that she calls the ring cosmos, which is the movement of life into generating complexity. But it's balanced by another ring that she calls the ring chaos, which is trying to reduce that complexity back into simplicity. And it's this energy of opposites really working together that enables that enables life to manifest itself. And in a sense, it's that kind of territory that we can look at, where life and death are always working together. So life is not easy, and if life were easy, and it's a bit like you get the image in the Odyssey, the image of the lotus eaters, the lotus eating island, where nothing happens because everything is so kind of perfect and lovely and there's no resistance to anything. But there's also then what happens is idleness and inertia. And actually there's something about the challenge of life. I mean, that's what, you know, Darwin points to as well when he looks at the principles of evolution and looks at the life as struggle. You know, it's that energy of life that struggles through. And in a way, it's why the ancient Egyptian image for this is the serpent. You know, the serpent is this, you know, profoundly ambiguous image, because the serpent is Apep, but the serpent is also, the serpent is the protective figure. The serpent is it's Mehen who protects Ra. It's the serpent guardians who enable our passage through the different gates. And in a way, part of what's being asked of us really is to embrace these opposites, and to be able to see ourselves as these beings who keep moving between things. The whole point about the serpent is the serpent is constantly in movement. And the thing about the great serpent image is serpents can arrange themselves, you know, in the Egyptian way of describing the serpent, a serpent can make lots of shapes. It's very, very flexible. Can stand up on end, it can be flat on the ground, it can be vertical, it can be horizontal, it can fashion itself into a chair that you can sit upon, it can tie you in knots, it can be a knot, it can unknot. So there's a whole lot of kind of qualities that we find in this image of the serpent. And when we contemplate this image of the scorpion goddess restraining the serpent, and the title they give her in the Book of Gates is She Who Breathes, She Who Enables Breath, which is one of Sirkut's titles. So what she's doing in the act of, and again we're with opposites, in the act of restraining, she is enabling breath.
Who's doing the serving?
The circuit to serve the scorpion goddess. Right, she's holding Apep back, and she's enabling the breath of the universe, which is because Apep wishes to stop that forward movement, wishes to stop our breath, in a sense. Wants to take us into inertia.
Could you please spell her name? I'm getting bored with knowing I'm spelling it wrongly every time.
Well, let's deal with S-E-R-Q-E-T, Serket.
Thank you.
Sometimes you'll find her described as Selket. So the Egyptians are nothing if not inconsistent, right? So there's also S-E-L-Q-E-T. Circuit Selket.
While I've interrupted, I'm really interested if anyone else have my experience. Thinking about this hour of inertia, I have never been more reluctant to come to this class than today.
Yeah,
at the 11th hour, this is the one I really had to, you know, I really could have done without coming to.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, not life or anything, just my instinctive feeling. I think affect having quite an effect on me. So I should push through.
Well, you're quite in the territory there, Penn, I think, really, because I think that's the energy of this hour. In fact, what we'll see as we look further at the book this weekend is that lots of energies have to be come together, because there's suddenly this right at the 11th hour there's this enormous attack upon the process. You know, and this is the moment where it could all fall apart. And I think, you know, it's very important this, because in creative endeavors very often one of the thing that probably is the most is not finishing something is one of the key things that destroys a lot of creative endeavors. You know, and it's such a common thing. And if you think back into your life, things that you nearly did, and maybe stopped, right? You know, there's stopping obviously that can happen just when you begin something, but there's more often than not, there's the stopping that happens when you're in the middle of something and you don't, and it's the absence of follow through. And this is what's being addressed in this hour, because theoretically everything should be fine. We've got, you know, we went into the depths, we've gone through the judgment of Osiris, we've contemplated the Geb posts, we're working with the energy of rising up, you know, so it all, in a way, it should all be plain sailing. But of course this is this energy of the 11th hour, right at the last moment it can all fall apart. And so the need for persistence, the need to kind of keep on going, really, is almost whatever, you know. It's what, you know, whatever, however things appear. The real need now is just to keep on, and not, you know, not to drop the ball just at this point.
I just got the, I think it's the motto, is it the RAF use it? And I'm trying to remember exactly. Per Ardua something Astra.
Mm-hmm.
Per Astra, yeah.
Mm. What's it mean? I can't remember what it means.
Through difficulty to the start.
Great. So, well, that's perfect. That's exactly it. Because literally where the, you know, where there's this process of the new dawn, but it's also the, in terms of the initiate's journey, you become one of the shining stars. And so that's a perfect, it is exactly that, through difficulty to the stars. So that's perfect in a way.
I suddenly realized in the meditation why Crowley talked about, well, he had his lodge, didn't he, the Argentum Astrum.
Yeah.
I didn't clock that one before, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of star.
No, well, interestingly, of course, you know, Crowley bases a lot of his teachings on the and something he calls the Stela of Revealing, which is one of the 25th dynasty Stela of, you know, the just like one that Paddy Aminope would have known. You know, so he's, I mean, Crowley is very much drawing on this ancient Egyptian tradition. And he also uses this that phrase quite often of initiates being servants of the star and the snake, which again comes absolutely out of Egyptian tradition. This is the kind of, because this is this image we get in the 12th hour of the of the completion being the woman sitting on the snake holding the star. And it's the idea of and actually part of the image of that is the image of the primacy of woman. Right, so that no matter what your sex, you end up as the woman sitting with the star and the snake. And it's the image of woman as the generative principle. And actually, it's interesting with Crowley. He actually describes the initiates of the Astra Magentum as all being women, whatever their sex. So, and it just, in some ways, it's kind of fascinating. There's a very kind of one-on-one matching between Crowley's ideas and Egyptian tradition. Although he himself, given when he was alive, would not have known a lot of this stuff. I mean, he wouldn't have had access. I mean, I don't think Crowley did, in fact, read hieroglyphics, so he wouldn't have known a lot of the things that we're talking about right now, really.
Can I ask about the strategies of Akkad for a minute?
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that, I mean, we all know that thing of inertia and not finishing project, but what happens is that we get a crisis of confidence,
yes,
fear, deep-seated insecurity and all this sort of thing. And it seems to me now that the antidote to that and the way to help ourselves push through is to get down to this deepest sense of myself made beautiful, which, yeah, goes underneath all that. It's surface anxiety. It doesn't feel like surface when you go through it.
No, not at all. Yeah, but that's exactly right. It's about getting deeper in, and this very powerful and challenging idea that the Egyptians have about myself made beautiful. You know, it's beautiful. It's a powerful idea, but challenging for us, particularly when ideas of beauty have become so normative and objectified. So the very specificity of the Egyptian idea is that it was rather your flesh and bones are beautiful. You know, your flesh, your bones, they are made of silver and gold. They are most precious. You know, so that is absolutely the antidote. And the thing about the crisis of confidence, as you say, it's incredibly powerful. It doesn't feel superficial at all. It just feels like, you know, this is all worthless and I'm worthless and you know, there's no point in me continuing. We look out at the world and everybody's doing it better than us anyway, so why should we bother? And you know, and it's all been done before, and you know, there's a whole lot of strategies really that voice can use to tell us that there isn't really any point in us continuing.
Just wanted to say, when you were talking a bit earlier about hatred,
yeah,
and self-hatred, I think that is certainly the last month or so something that I've been really struggling with.
Yeah.
I've always struggled with it, but particularly, it's been particularly intense, I would say, the last month or so.
Okay.
I'm just trying not to be waylaid by it, and not ignore it, but just be with it and sit with it and invite it in and befriend it.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult thing to do, but I still struggle with that. But yeah, so that's just, it's just been very potent, I would say, the last few weeks, that feeling of hatred and self-hatred.
I think there's something really important then about recognizing this energy as an energy, right? So rather than because there's something complicated can happen around that with self-hatred. You can hate yourself for hating yourself. You know, it can get very convoluted. So there's something about, it's a bit like recognizing, oh, here's self-hatred again, here's that energy. So meeting it kind of clearly without identifying with it, noticing here it is again, my old friend, you know, my old enemy, you know, and in a way, I think that's partly what the book is trying to tell us, that this energy just does keep on coming. And since the, and the there's a subtle danger in it that we can feel depressed or hating of ourselves because it keeps on coming. Now this is just an energy of the universe, just an energy of challenge somewhere. And there's something about matching the challenge, noticing it, feeling clear, instead of feeling disheartened by the fact that that energy is around, just, you know, accepting that the challenge of that. Okay, let's notice your self-hatred again.
Yeah.
And there's something about, you know, and that's why they have this counterbalance image of myself made beautiful, so that this is not me, right? This is an energy of the universe coming through and through aspects of my psyche, an energy that resists my the expression of myself made beautiful.
No, then when you say earlier, dealing with hatred
Yeah. Well, it's a bit like, so in that energy, one of the things that's important, right, is to sort of so when we say self-hatred is operating, there is something about meeting that energy with the same kind of clarity. So it's a sort of, so it's like so it isn't like you work yourself up emotionally to hate it, but actually it's the, well, you know, hating, the energy of hate is the energy that rejects something and separates from something. So as we look at the energy, so as you look clearly at that energy of self-hatred, and as we clearly recognize that that is not a good energy, that should not be, that should not exist. It is my will that this should not exist. Right, that, then we meet that energy with the same energy that's trying to get into us. Because what that energy is doing ultimately is trying to persuade us that we are not who we really are. So to hate that is to challenge that. It's a sort of energy of clarity, really.
Better word for me is for clarity, because you could have a hate-a-thon here.
Yeah. No, sure. And then obviously, one of the things going to happen in the world, you know, these days is hate, you know, but there's a sort of... But I suppose the energy, that what I like about the energy of hate, because it is a difficult thing, is it is a rejection of something. It is saying, I am not this.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, that's the clarity it brings, in a way.
Yeah. I'd like to add to that, I think that was amazing what Pam has just said. My big thing that's been coming up in the last few weeks is just... it's just profound, deep, intense loneliness, and that sense of being, you know, that I've never belonged. And I know I've always had it, but it's been, you know, it's just been exacerbated. It's like that sense, and that is a rejection. As you were talking, I realised, that is also a rejection.
Yeah.
You know, that total sort of, I don't know quite how, you know, it's... I don't know whether it's, yeah, because I mean, I've got plenty of reasons, you know, like no, you know, family left and stuff like that. But it was also interesting meeting Selkirk, because as soon as you said the Scorpion goddess, I thought, oh my God, that's my mother. You know, she was a Scorpio. And there's something about having to hand over my power to the Scorpion goddess, because I actually ended up mothering her rather than she mothering me. So there was never a sense of me in terms of what I needed or wanted, because I somehow had to do it for her.
Yeah.
So for me, meeting that was profound, because also I didn't want to have to deal with this. You know, it's a really, that for me is such a, that difficult transition. I have worked with it. I mean, I've worked with it in family constellations, so it's something about isolating. I don't know whether there's any more clarity you can put on.
No, well, yeah. I think that's it. I mean, that's part of what you're talking about. That is like that up energy, right? That energy of isolation. And that's why the counter to that is myself made beautiful.
Mm.
The beauty of myself. Right, so because that isolating energy, that kind of which that energy that comes out of the past, that says that I don't matter, right? My needs don't matter. My who I am, more than that, actually, it's more than that. It's who I am doesn't matter. Who I am is not included in the bundle of life. As opposed to myself made beautiful, who is at the heart of life, who is needed by the universe, who is part of the beauty of the universe. Now that's the challenging thing that the Egyptians say to us, really, that it's in order to work with that energy, to not be overwhelmed by that energy of Apep, we have to find our relationship with myself made beautiful. And part of that, and part of being able to get to that point, is seeing clearly that energy of Apep. So what you're seeing clearly there right now in the sense of your mother, and the sense of well, not just that, but whatever in your life has produced this sense of I am isolated, I am separate from, I am not connected to. So that is all part of that energy of Apep that works against myself made beautiful. Because in the sense of being myself made beautiful is to be at the heart of life, connected to everything, and needed by life in order to do that somewhere.
And I think my physical condition is linked into that too, as well.
Oh, yeah. Sure, yeah, it's hard.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So just about 5 minutes left before we have our lunch breaks. Anybody else got any questions or thoughts they want to share before we finish, before we break for lunch?
Can you just say what the phrase myself made beautiful is in Egyptian again?
In Egyptian, the phrase they use is Asar Unefa, which means a made beautiful Osiris. So in Egyptian tradition, the dead are always called an Osiris. So they could, because they identify with this energy of the resurrection, resurrecting energy. And the old word, the Osiris is a Greek word. The older word in Egyptian is Asar, A-S-A-R. So Asar Un Nefa. N-E-F-E-R. Nefer is beautiful, Un is made. So it means to become, so the idea they have is becoming a beautiful Osiris, becoming this energy of life that dies and recreates itself, that is fallen apart and then comes together and is reborn in beauty, and is continually made beautiful. And in a way, that's the image is right at the heart of this. That's why in the deepest part of the night we meet Osiris, we are judged by Osiris, we become one with Osiris, and then we enter into this latter part of this, the journey, we enter part into this resurrecting energy of Osiris, which more and more affirms the idea of Asar Unefa, ourselves made beautiful. We are the beautiful Osiris that comes up with the grain. And in a way, you can really notice this energy this time of year as the plants are starting to, you know, look in my garden, look at the tulips coming up. It's that energy. This is the, if in Egyptians, this would be the green barley coming out of the earth. This is a, you know, because there's a whole festival in Egypt where they would make little Osiris shaped earth molds, in which barley would be planted. And then in the springtime energy, what would happen is that the you get this sprouting barley effigies of Osiris, which represents this energy of resurrection, the energy of new life emerging.
I was just going to say, I was glad you used the word sort of precious earlier, because like you said, our associations with the word beautiful, it's so surface.
Very difficult, yeah.
It's hard for us to get a grip on that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, because the Egyptian idea of beauty is not like our modern idea of beauty. It's very it's really, you know, it's right at the heart of their understanding of life. You know, the idea that life is beautiful, all the forms of life are beautiful. You know, and
what association? Sorry,
sorry, go on. Say again. Yeah.
Our associations at its surface.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
The opposite, in a way. There's a big issue with that in our culture, I would say.
Oh, there's a huge issue. I mean, I was listening to a radio thing the other day. With people talking about people who've got addicted to putting filters on their Instagram pages and in their, so that their bodies look different, and they were talking about, you know, quite sad really. People are talking about, you know, there's a young woman talking about how she'd learned to wean herself off the addiction of using filters, and then she was very eloquent, really. She just described how the filtered image of herself, having identified with the filtered image of herself, it had alienated herself from her own body, her own form, which she perceived constantly as ugly. And that she just had to go through a whole journey of, if you like, of ridding herself of the obsessing image of herself, of the so-called idealized beautiful self, that actually was really acting as an idol and acting as an oppressive image that was destroying, eroding her own actual sense of inner beauty. So, so there's something about reclaiming this image of beauty that expressing it differently. That's actually quite important, really, because one of the great energies of our culture at the moment is this idea of us all becoming these bizarre externalized forms. You know, if you look at, I don't know if you have ever watched The Only Way Is Essex. You're probably not an audience that does it. I occasionally look at it because I'm fascinated. But all the people there look the same.
Yeah.
There's often surgery has been used. There's certainly makeup for men and women are used, and clothes are used in such a way that they absolutely look the same because they've all got help them trying to conform to this an externalized image of what beauty is.
Facebook and Instagram, and the kids, the young girls now, are constantly looking at themselves, yeah, being forced, yeah, and people are interacting through these images.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a big issue, I think.
No, it's an enormous issue, and that's why all this work that we're doing around the icon and the idol is more relevant than ever somewhere, because there's so much around the externalization of image and the oppression of image, rather than images being things that enable, that open us into, you know, deeper, more mysterious places. They're becoming these forms that lock people up. And then the whole mechanism, the whole visual mechanism of social media and the use of smartphones means that that's a constant and powerful energy in human life at the moment.
The thing that really, the youth, isn't it? It's also attached, the idea of beauty, to youth.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
But the thing that really freaks me out is the way they all speak the same. I mean, you've got to have a gravelly voice and you just speak in this way, and it's the American sort of upswing with the words, you know?
Yeah.
And it's so, even the voice, even your truth is being disguised, yeah, in this sort of fakery, really.
No, I think that's right, and I think that's why, in a way, the more of us who can just work with these dynamics and do this difficult work of aligning with myself made beautiful.
I just want to sort of put a word in for age here.
Good.
Age, when you age, you lose your outer beauty, unless you're very under the knife or something. So you're faced with that, the reality of it. So it's inner beauty that you're trying to go for, because what else is there to do, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's only if you think of beauty as being youthful. I mean, if you think beauty is held in the body of a 17-year-old, then you're onto a loser, really, for the whole of your life, aren't you? I couldn't imagine these people who have toy boys and trophy wives. I think, how can you love anyone without a line on their face, you know? Mm-hmm. How? Where's their character? What's life taught them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Just thought.
No, I think that's right. But I think Andy's also right, that one of the powers of aging is that is you, the outer, unless you go, I mean, some people do, of course, go to extraordinary lengths, and actually when you see, you know, some people in the 70s sometimes have got, well, haven't got any lines on it, but they, you know, they, God help them, they've ended up with plastic faces. I mean, that's the
Jane Fonda is one of them.
Who? Jane Fonda. Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah.
Who's that?
I feel I need to barge in here and just
feels
like, I think, I mean, I know very little about Egyptian history, but Cleopatra is surely one of the most sort of like Cleopatra. I'm going to say something that crass just for the effect.
Yeah, go on.
The Kardashian of our day.
Well, the funny thing about it is, if you actually look at what images we have of Cleopatra, she wasn't that attractive. But I think that's interesting. You see, the whole Cleopatra image, which is really kind of based on what's her name? Richard Burton's partner,
Liz Taylor.
So Liz Taylor has almost the image of Liz Taylor has sort of eclipsed the image of Cleopatra. Because that's I notice that when I instinctively think of Cleopatra, sort of a Liz Taylor kind of lookalike pops up in my head. But the actual image, you see some of the coinage, Cleopatra's coinage, is that she's actually got quite a severe face, a massive nose.
Yeah.
So not conventionally beautiful, and sort of, and of course the image you do have, I suppose, of a conventional beauty from ancient Egypt is the bust of Nefertiti, Akhenaton's wife, and you know, and sort of, and so it's not to say that also there would have been all kinds of other dynamics going on in Egypt, you know, that, you know, suggesting Egypt didn't have any externalization of beauty. I'm really sure it did, because all human societies do. But I guess in its deeper traditions, it had a wholly different idea, because right at the heart of the whole spiritual tradition is this idea of Asa Unetha, myself made beautiful, Osiris made beautiful. And you see a bit of it later on in the Greeks, where you see beauty is one of the attributes that, when Plato talks about the good, the beautiful, and the true, you know, beauty is there as a central thing. So we get that in ancient Greece as well. But we need to finish, I guess, but I'll just finish on this. What happens is with the development of Christianity, is you get a rejection of all those external ideas, and alongside that, a rejection of woman as representing sexuality and life, and so all those ideas of beauty vanishes into a puritanical sense of moral beauty, and outer beauty is not important at all. Now, in part, a lot of the thrust of the 20th century and the 21st century has been away from that kind of, if you like, medieval and post-medieval tradition into the appreciation of the opposite of that. But that's now got to another great extreme. So where outer beauty is almost is everything, you know, and sort of and inner beauty is nothing. So again, it's just noticing the way these energies swing back and forth in our collective experience. And it's what's interesting is how if you find it happening in the Renaissance, you see the idea of beauty in Christian art sneaking in, often through the figure of Mary Magdalene, who's often presented in a very seductive kind of image. And although occasionally you get daring images of the Virgin, where she looks like she has some sense of sexuality and beauty, but more often than not, it's Mary Magdalene that does that. So there's something about the power of this. Again, we're back with the power of the image, the outer image, the inner image, the image that operates as an icon, the image that operates as an idol. So this is right at the heart of everything we've been looking at. Anyway, let's have a break for lunch, and Come back at 1:30, and we'll continue our inquiry. So have a nice lunch.
Thank you.
Feed the inner person.
that was a brilliant session. Thank you so much.
I'm glad. Good.
Good lunch, everybody.
Have a good lunch, guys.